Our strength, wealth, and commerce grow out of the skilled labor of the men working in metals. They are at the foundation of our manufacturing greatness.
Today on Vox Talks, the vital contribution of clockmakers and millwrights to Britain's industrial success. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, that quote at the beginning was from Richard Cobden. He was an English statesman in the 19th century, and he knew more than most people about who and what had created the Industrial Revolution. And, like many of his contemporaries, he gave credit to the workers who used their mechanical skills to build and improve the sophisticated new machinery that revolutionised industrial production at the time. A new CEPR discussion paper that's just published, called The Mechanics of the Industrial Revolution, asks how important those skilled practitioners were. And the authors are Morgan Kelly, Joe Mokia, and Cormac O'Grada. And Joe Mokia, Northwestern University and the University of Tel Aviv, joins me today. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello.
Now, this paper refers to artisans. What sort of jobs did this group of people do at that time?
Well, artisans are basically the people who made almost everything that wasn't grown on the field, right? So they made shoes and they made furniture and they made clothing and toys and everything you'd buy that wasn't food. They also, importantly enough, repaired things. I mean, this is still not the throwaway society that we live in which very few people actually repair something. If it breaks down, you just throw it away and buy a new one. And, you know, in the 18th century, clearly, there was an army of people who were repairing things, maintaining things, and they're artisans as well.
Were these skilled workers equally available all over Britain? Were they easy to find?
Obviously, every area needs a basis of artisans who supply the needs of that particular community. So you have masons and carpenters and such probably spread all over Britain. But you also have specialized areas that specialize in particular artisanal skills. You know, there's an area in which you have clockmakers up in Lancashire, and you have silk weavers in London, and you have wool finishers in Gloucestershire. So, you know, there is specialization going on, and some areas have higher concentration of these artisans than others.
We all know about the great men of the Industrial Revolution, people like Arkwright and Watt. What did this group of people do to help them during the Industrial Revolution?
Well, I have sort of reached the conclusion late in life that, in fact, this group of people were essential. They are, to put it very crudely, the difference between inventions that were made on paper in somebody's head but could never be realized, and what happened during the Industrial Revolution, in which people come up with ideas, and then there's somebody else, usually, who can actually build this thing from blueprint, scale it up, produce it not once, not twice, but, you know, hundreds of times, and every time it works. The more I think about it, that probably isn't there even as late as, say, 1500 or 1600. There's a continued improvement in the skills of artisans, particularly in Britain during the sort of late 17th, 18th century, that made this possible. And I think if it hadn't been for this group of people, the Industrial Revolution may just have happened on paper, and you would get, you know, the same kind of thing that you got out of somebody like Leonardo. You know, so Leonardo was a great inventor, but as everybody knows, none of the things that he designed and sketched could ever be built at his time. And the reasons basically were workmanship and materials. And I think what British artisans supplied to the inventors were those two ingredients that really were critical.
You've made this determination, Joel, but you look at most economic interpretations of what caused the Industrial Revolution. They don't focus very much on this type of human capital. Why not?
Well, The quick answer would be, well, but nobody thought of it before I did. That's not, of course, true. That's not really true. In fact, there are people who have argued this a while ago, but it's never gotten the kind of tension, I think, that it's gotten in the last few years, in part through that my collaboration with a variety of people who are looking at different aspects of this. I think there are two reasons. The first is that when we talk about human capital, we have very much a modern notion of human capital. Mm. We think of young lads going to school, being taught the three R's, you know, reading books, you know. We think of that as human capital, and the way we look at it is we ask how many people were literate, or to be more exact, how many signed marriage certificates, right? So if you signed with your name, you were literate. If you put down an X, you weren't, and that's how we know human capital. And then if you're lucky, you can find a little bit more information about who went to school. And it's become my conviction that that's fine, but that is not where these artisans came from. Schools don't produce artisans, not in this time, and not even today. Artisans were made by other artisans. That's how the system worked. And you know, that, I think it's taken a while for people to realize how critical the operation of the system that produced artisans really was, and that in some countries it worked better than in others, and that's where that country had better artisans. And the country that had better artisans was called Britain. And that's why British artisans not only were the first to build all these things, but then eventually when the continent wanted to imitate Britain, because they could see how much wealth is created, they had to bring in English and Scottish engineers and mechanics in large numbers to help them install and operate and maintain this equipment, because they couldn't do it.
Let's have a look at the research you're able to do on this. If you want to evaluate their influence economically, what hypotheses can you test for here?
Well, so there are various ways of getting around the scarcity of data for this period. The big dilemma is that the sort of systematic sources that the modern economists would like to use, such as the census, really don't become very useful until the middle of the 19th century. It's true that Britain is having a census every 10 years from 1801 on, but the first two or three censuses really can't be used very much because they're pretty crude and the information in them is pretty lame. And that improves a lot in 1841 and 1851. And so one of the things that we have been able to do is use retrospective data from 1851 and look at the availability of artisans at an earlier period. You know, that in this particular case could be done. Now, like all historical data, you know, there's lots of noise in it and there's lots of errors in it. But that's actually true for modern data as well. But you could test hypotheses. And one of the things that we found in the paper that you mentioned was that the prior availability at an earlier stage of what we call high quality mechanics predicts the degree of industrialization at a later stage. And so the prior availability of highly skilled artisans is obviously an important factor in where industrialization occurred in Britain first. And by inference, of course, you would say it's not just the geographical dispersion within England, so that it's really in certain areas in the Midlands and in the Scottish lowlands and so on, but it also you could say this is what happened in Britain and not in Poland.
And so you're looking back from that 1851 data at what the situation would have been many years before when these industries were growing up in particular regions and being able to match that with the availability of skills. Is that what's happening?
That's exactly right. And so just to be a little bit more detailed about it. So the 1851 census has tables in which they give you occupation by age. And so what we basically did is we said, well, let's just look at the old guys. So people in their 60s and 70s and look what their occupations are. And, you know, if you were a mechanic at age 70, it's likely that you were a mechanic at age 20. You know, people basically picked a profession and they apprenticed in it. And then they, you know, that's what they did for the rest of their lives. And so you have to make certain assumptions that these people didn't move around too much. So where they lived in 1851 was roughly where they lived in 1800. But apart from that, that's the kind of information that you can use to see how well endowed a particular county was with these sort of high-skilled mechanics.
And given the limitations on that data, it does support your hypothesis that where these skills were available, that's where mechanization happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's more, I would venture, this is not so much based on data, but I would venture that when you look at the great inventors, when you look at people like James Watt, okay, they actually would go where the artisans were that could build their things.
Oh,
it's not
yes.
like the artisans came to the inventors went to the artisans. That's, I think, true across the board. Okay? The location of these high-skilled people, that was really the binding constraint, so to speak, on mechanizing your manufacturing process, because, you know, you could buy the machines and you could, you know, schlep these machines around Britain, but you needed people who could fix them. Because remember one thing, in this time, this is not an age of interchangeable parts. Each steam engine, each spinning mule is a unique specimen, has its own quirks. And so you need somebody who can look at this thing and come up with a bunch of manual tools and say, all right, here's why this isn't working, and fixing it. And that's, you know, that's really tough. I mean, I'll tell you this, Tim. You know, the guy who fixes my car in Chicago, he doesn't fix anything. He looks at the car and he says, ah, the computer says that part number 73 is broken. He takes a screwdriver, takes out part number 73, sticks in another part 73 that's identical to the one that broke down, and I'm good to go. That's not the way you fix a steam engine in 1800. In 1800, you actually look at what's wrong with it and you fix that. That's where the skills come in.
Can you be sure you got causality the right way round here, that it wasn't that people were training in those skills because industrialization had started and they knew there'd be a demand? Because the guy who fixes your car in Chicago, he trained to fix cars because he knew there'd be a demand for it.
Yes. Yeah, but we do know that Britain has these skilled people already before we can see much traces of the Industrial Revolution. You know, there's people writing about how clever British mechanics are in the 1720s. Defoe writes about it, and all kind of visitors who come to England. Already by the middle of the 18th century, long before James Watt, everybody knew that if you wanted a good mechanic anywhere in Europe, you'd brought in somebody from Britain. The French surely knew it. The Germans knew it. Everybody knew it. And what's more, if you were a continental inventor, and so you had come up with something, because the continent had lots of good inventors, but if you wanted it built and make money, you actually traveled to England. You found yourself an English artisan who could build it for you. What these people didn't know is that if you went to England, you could get somebody who would build your machine, but you'd also find somebody who'd rip you off. And so very few of these people actually made money, but that's a separate story. But the fact that they thought that they would have to come to England to have this damn thing built, that tells you something about that they knew that that's where these high skills were.
Over the years, there have been a lot of competing explanations for the causes of the Industrial Revolution. Some of them have got your name on as well. And there are things like the high price of labor and the availability of coal and literacy you've already mentioned and the availability of credit. Does this research you're doing now mean that all these factors aren't maybe as important as we thought they were?
Well, in something like an Industrial Revolution is always sort of overdetermined. You know, there are more factors that explain it than you'd ever need if you wanted to use Occam's razor. I cannot say that what we have found rules out other factors. Some of these other factors, I think, are just bogus. For instance, the notion that somehow because Britain had very expensive workers, so to speak, that that's where there was an incentive for people to come up with labor-saving devices. I think that's basically wrong. I mean, for reasons that I'm not going to go into. There's a long debate, which I have participated in, on how important coal was. Very many distinguished scholars who basically said, look, to have an Industrial Revolution, you really needed to have coal. And the fact that Britain had coal, and what's more, it had coal and iron in good proximity, really was a big advantage. Mm. And my take on that is that that's probably true. Coal did matter, but we should never forget that the coal's been in the ground there for millions of years. I mean, that's what coal is. When Julius Caesar came to England, there wasn't any less coal than there was in 1800, but he didn't know how to use it. He didn't know how to find it. He couldn't transport it. And even if he could, the only thing they would be able to use it for is domestic heating. You know, using it for industrial purposes. For that, you needed knowledge. You needed skills. You needed aptitude. And that's what is really behind everything. Obviously, your skill and your knowledge that will be geared toward exploiting that coal. But it's not the coal that does it. It's the knowledge. It's people being smart. And there's two kinds of smartness which you alluded to in your intro. The first is the sort of James Watt, John Smeaton kind of smartness, okay? People who are really part of the great inventors, unusual minds, people think outside the box, brilliant engineers who really could come up with totally new ideas, okay? But they are, as I said, nothing without the people who can carry them out. That's an aptitude as well. Both of those things were completely unavailable when Julius Caesar came to England. They're still very rare at the time of the Wars of the Roses or something, which is why we don't see an industrial revolution in Tudor times. By the 17th, 18th century, we see these skills growing rapidly. And I think that's what helps explain the timing of the industrial revolution. It also explains why it happened in Britain and way before it happened anywhere else, and why Britain was so important for these other countries to adopt its techniques, because it did have all these English and Scottish mechanics who traveled all over Europe. You know, one of the stories I tell my students is the story of Donetsk. You know, so Donetsk is the great town of heavy industry in the eastern Ukraine. So the city of Donetsk used to be called Yuzovka. And Yuzovka is named after a man called John Hughes. And John Hughes was a Welshman, an ironmaster, who traveled to Russia at the invitation of the Russian government and founded the heavy industry that's still the basis of prosperity in eastern Ukraine. If you go to what's called today Donetsk, you see a big statue to John Hughes standing there, and it says, John Hughes, you know, founder of the iron industry in our town. And people like that are all over Europe. I have found them in Portugal, I found them in the Netherlands, in Germany, in the Habsburg Empire, because Britain had them and these other guys didn't.
It's a remarkable piece of history, and it's a fantastic economics as well. Joel, thank you very much.
My pleasure, my friend.
Are you going to be doing some more research into this, Joel, by the way?
Well, what else is a guy like me about to do? I'm too old to take up the cello, you know? So, yeah, I'm actually writing a book with two co-authors, very well-known economists. One is Avner Greif at Stanford, who used to be my student, and there is a guy at in Italy called Guido Tabellini. We're writing a book which is on a slightly more ambitious topic, which is sort of to try to understand the difference in economic development between Europe and China.
Oh.
This is not Europe and Asia, and it is not Britain and China, it's Europe and China. These are the units that we picked more or less on purpose. We're coming up with, a novel explanation of why we get the great reversal. So the great reversal is that, you know, the year 1000, as everybody knows, Europe was a barbarous and violent backwater in which literacy rates were like 1%. And China is very sophisticated, advanced, technologically superior place that's on the verge of an industrial revolution in many ways. You know, they have cotton, they have iron, they have coal. I mean, it looks like that's where the industrial revolution should have happened. And it doesn't. And we wait another 700 years, and then Europe finally is overtaking China, and the rest is history. That's a huge puzzle. Not so much, I think, what went wrong with China. People have often phrased it that way, and I think that's actually probably the wrong way of thinking it. It's not China that's the exception, it's Europe. Because what happened in China in somewhat different way also happened in the Islamic world. You know, if you look at the Islamic world at about the same time, say 1000 AD, you see a world that is vastly more sophisticated than Europe. We don't see an industrial revolution in the Ottoman Empire either. And so it may well be that stagnation is the rule. What is to be explained is, and this is, of course, very unpopular today, but it's European exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
But it would take me too long to explain it all. But if you want to set up another one of those meetings, I'll be glad to do it for you.
Meanwhile, download this paper and read it. That's discussion paper 14884. It is called The Mechanics of the Industrial Revolution, and the authors Morgan Kelly, Joel Mokia, and Koma Kogorada. Joel, I won't keep you from your work, but when you've finished your book, we will definitely have you back on to talk about it.
Well, as soon as we're done here, I'm going back to, I think, chapter 4.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week. So subscribe to Vox Talks and you will never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.